officers, seemingly exactly like other captains in the Lancers. Another, a small dentist from Fulham, in all reasonable certainty, precisely like every other dentist from Fulham. Major Brown, small, dry, and dapper, was one of these. Basil had made his acquaintance over a discussion in a hotel cloakroom about the right hat, a discussion which reduced the little major almost to a kind of masculine hysterics, the compound of the selfishness of an old bachelor and the scrupulosity of an old maid. They had gone home in a cab together and then dined with each other twice a week until they died. I myself was another. I had met Grant while he was still a judge, on the balcony of the National Liberal Club, and exchanged a few words about the weather. Then we had talked for about an hour about politics and God, for men always talk about the most important things to total strangers. It is because in the total stranger we perceive man himself. The image of God is not disguised by resemblances to an uncle or doubts of the wisdom of a mustache. One of the most interesting of Basil's motley groups of acquaintances was Professor Chad. He was known to the ethnological world, which is a very interesting world but a long way off this one, as the second greatest, if not the greatest, authority on the relations of savages to language. He was known to the neighborhood of Hart Street, Bloomsbury, as a bearded man with a bald head, spectacles, and a patient face, the face of an unaccountable nonconformist who had forgotten how to be angry. He went to and fro between the British Museum and a selection of blameless tea shops, with an armful of books and a poor but honest umbrella. He was never seen without the books and the umbrella, and was supposed, by the lighter wits of the Persian MS room, to go to bed with them in his little brick villa in the neighborhood of Shepherd's Bush. There he lived with three sisters, ladies of solid goodness but sinister demeanor. His life was happy, as are almost all the lives of methodical students, but one would not have called it exhilarating. His only hours of exhilaration occurred when his friend Basil Grant came into the house late at night, a tornado of conversation. Basil, though close on 60, had moods of boisterous babyishness, and there seemed for some reason or other to descend upon him particularly in the house of his studious and almost dingy friend. I can remember vividly, for I was acquainted with both parties and often dined with them, the gaiety of Grant on that particular evening when the strange calamity fell upon the professor. Professor Chad was, like most of his particular class and type, the class that is at once academic and middle class, a radical of a solemn and old-fashioned type. Grant was a radical himself, but he was that more discriminating and not uncommon type of radical who passes most of his time in abusing the radical party. Chad had just contributed to a magazine an article called Zulu Interests and the New Macango Frontier, in which a precise scientific report of his study of the customs of the people of T'Chaka was reinforced by a severe protest against certain interferences with these customs both by the British and the Germans. He was sitting with the magazine in front of him, the lamplight shining on his spectacles, a wrinkle in his forehead, not of anger but of perplexity, as Basil Grant strode up and down the room, shaking it with his voice, with his high spirits and his heavy tread. "It's not your opinions that I object to, my esteemed Chad," he was saying, "it's you. You are quite right to champion the Zulus, but for all that you do not sympathize with them. No doubt you know the Zulu way of cooking tomatoes and the Zulu prayer before blowing one's nose, but for all that you don't understand them as well as I do, who don't know an assegai from an alligator. You are more learned, Chad, but I am more Zulu. Why is it that the jolly old barbarians of this earth are always championed by people who are their antithesis? Why is it? You are sagacious, you are benevolent, you are well-informed. But, Chad, you are not savage. Live no longer under that rosy illusion. Look in the glass. Ask your sisters. Consult the librarian of the British Museum. Look at this umbrella." And he held up that sad but still respectable article. "Look at it. For 10 mortal years, to my certain knowledge, you have carried that object under your arm, and I have no sort of doubt that you carried it at the age of 8 months, and it never occurred to you to give one wild yell and hurl it like a javelin. Thus, and he sent the umbrella whizzing past the professor's bald head so that it knocked over a pile of books with a crash and left a vase rocking. Professor Chad appeared totally unmoved with his face still lifted to the lamp and the wrinkle cut in his forehead. "Your mental processes," he said, "always go a little too fast, and they are stated without method. There is no kind of inconsistency, and no words can convey the time he took to get to the end of the word. Between valuing the right of the Aborigines to adhere to their stage in the evolutionary process, so long as they find it congenial and requisite to do so. There is, I say, no inconsistency between this concession, which I have just described to you, and the view that the evolutionary stage in question is, nevertheless, so far as we can form any estimate of values in the variety of cosmic processes, definable in some degree as an inferior evolutionary stage." Nothing but his lips had moved as he spoke, and his glasses still shone like two pallid moons. Grant was shaking with laughter as we watched him. "True," he said, "there is no inconsistency, my son of the Red Spear, but there is a great deal of incompatibility of temper. I am very far from being certain that the Zulu is on an inferior evolutionary stage, whatever the blazes that may mean. I do not think there is anything stupid or ignorant about howling at the moon or being afraid of devils in the dark. It seems to me perfectly philosophical. Why should a man be thought a sort of idiot because he feels the mystery and peril of existence itself? Suppose, my dear Chad, suppose it is we who are the idiots because we are not afraid of devils in the dark." Professor Chad slit open a page of the magazine with a bone paper knife in the intent reverence of the bibliophile. "Beyond all question," he said, "it is a tenable hypothesis. I allude to the hypothesis, which I understand you to entertain, that our civilization is not or may not be in advance upon, and indeed, if I apprehend you, is or may be a retrogression from states identical with or analogous to the state of the Zulus. Moreover, I shall be inclined to concede that such a proposition is of the nature, in some degree at least, of a primary proposition, and cannot adequately be argued in the same sense, I mean, that the primary proposition of pessimism or the primary proposition of the non-existence of matter cannot adequately be argued. But I do not conceive you to be under the impression that you have demonstrated anything more concerning this proposition than that it is tenable, which, after all, amounts to little more than the statement that it is not a contradiction in terms." Basil threw a book at his head and took out a cigar. "You don't understand," he said, "but on the other hand, as a compensation, you don't mind smoking? Why you don't object to that disgustingly barbaric rite, I can't think. I can only say that I began it when I began to be a Zulu, about the age of 10. What I maintained was that although you knew more about Zulus in the sense that you are a scientist, I know more about them in the sense that I am a savage. For instance, your theory of the origin of language, something about it having come from the formulated secret language of some individual creature, though you knocked me silly with facts and scholarship in its favor, still does not convince me, because I have a feeling that that is not the way that things happen. If you ask me why I think so, I can only answer that I am a Zulu. And if you ask me, as you most certainly will, what is my definition of a Zulu, I can answer that also. He is one who has climbed a Sussex apple tree at 7 and been afraid of a ghost in an English lane." "Your process of thought," began the immovable Chad, but his speech was interrupted. His sister, with that masculinity which always in such families concentrates in sisters, flung open the door with a rigid arm and said, "James, Mr. Bingham of the British Museum wants to see you again." The philosopher rose with a dazed look, which always indicates in such men the fact that they regard philosophy as a familiar thing, but practical life as a weird and unnerving vision, and walked dubiously out of the room. "I hope you do not mind my being aware of it, Miss Chad," said Basil Grant, "but I hear that the British Museum has recognized one of the men who have deserved well of their commonwealth. It is true, it is not, that Professor Chad is likely to be made keeper of Asiatic manuscripts?" The grim face of the spinster betrayed a great deal of pleasure and a great deal of pathos also. "I believe it's true," she said. If it is, it will not only be great glory, which women, I assure you, feel a great deal, but great relief, which they feel more. Relief from worry from a lot of things. James' health has never been good, and while we are as poor as we are, he had to do journalism and coaching, in addition to his own dreadful grinding notions and discoveries, which he loves more than man, woman, or child. I have often been afraid that unless something of this kind occurred, we should really have to be careful of his brain. But I believe it is practically settled. I am delighted, began Basil with a worried face, but these red tape negotiations are so terribly chancy that I really can't advise you to build on hope, only to be hurled down into bitterness. I've known men, and good men like your brother, come nearer than this and be disappointed. Of course, if it is true, said the woman fiercely, it means that people who have never lived may make an attempt at living. Even as she spoke, the professor came into their room, still with the dazed look in his eyes. Is it true? Asked Basil with burning eyes. Not a bit true, answered Chad after a moment's bewilderment. Your argument was, in 3 points, fallacious. What do you mean? Demanded Grant. Well, said the professor slowly, in saying that you could possess a knowledge of the essence of Zulu life distinct from... Oh, confound Zulu life, cried Grant with a burst of laughter. I mean, have you got the post? You mean the post of keeper of the Asiatic manuscripts, he said, opening his eye with childlike wonder. Oh, yes, I got that. But the real objection to your argument, which has only, I admit, occurred to me since I have been out of the room, is that it does not merely presuppose a Zulu truth apart from the facts, but infers that the discovery of it is absolutely impeded by the facts. I am crushed, said Basil, and sat down to laugh, while the professor's sister retired to her room, possibly, possibly not. It was extremely late when we left the Chads, and it is an extremely long and tiresome journey from Shepherd's Bush to Lambeth. This may be our excuse for the fact that we, for I was stopping the night with Grant, got down to breakfast next day at a time inexpressibly criminal, a time, in point of fact, close upon noon. Even to that belated meal we came in a very lounging and leisurely fashion. Grant, in particular, seemed so dreamy at table that he scarcely saw the pile of letters by his plate, and I doubt if he would have opened any of them if there had not lain on the top that one thing which had succeeded amid modern carelessness in being really urgent and coercive, the telegram. This he opened with the same heavy distraction with which he broke his egg and drank his tea. When he read it, he did not stir a hair or say a word, but something, I know not what, made me feel that the motionless figure had been pulled together suddenly as strings are tightened on a slack guitar. Though he said nothing and did not move, I knew that he had been for an instant cleared and sharpened with a shock of cold water. It was scarcely any surprise to me when a man who had drifted sullenly to his seat and fallen into it kicked it away like a cur from under him, and came round to me in 2 strides. What do you make of that? He said, and flattened out the wire in front of me. It ran, Please come at once. James, mental state dangerous. Chad. What does the woman mean? I said after a pause irritably. Those women have been saying that the poor old professor was mad ever since he was born. You are mistaken, said Grant composedly. It is true that all sensible women... think all studious men are mad. It is true, for the matter of that, all women of any kind think all men of any kind mad, but they don't put it in telegrams any more than they wire to you that grass is green or God all-merciful. These things are truisms, and often private ones at that. If Miss Chad had written down under the eye of a strange woman in a post office that her brother is off his head, you may be perfectly certain that she did it because it was a matter of life and death, and she can think of no other way of forcing us to come promptly. It will force us, of course, I said, smiling. Oh, yes, he replied. There is a cab rank near. Basil scarcely said a word as we drove across Westminster Bridge, through Trafalgar Square, along Piccadilly, and up the Uxbridge Road. Only as he was opening the gate, he spoke. I think you will take my word for it, my friend, he said. This is one of the most queer and complicated and astounding incidents that ever happened in London, or, for that matter, in any high civilization. I confess with the greatest sympathy and reverence that I don't quite see it, I said. Is it so very extraordinary or complicated that a dreamy, somnambulant old invalid who has always walked on the borders of the inconceivable should go mad under the shock of great joy? Is it so very extraordinary that a man with a head like a turnip and a soul like a spider's web should not find his strength equal to a confounding change of fortunes? Is it, in short, so very extraordinary that James Chadd should lose his wits from excitement? It would not be extraordinary in the least, answered Basil with placidity. It would not be extraordinary in the least, he repeated, if the professor had gone mad. That was not the extraordinary circumstance to which I referred. What, I asked, stamping my foot, was the extraordinary thing? The extraordinary thing, said Basil, ringing the bell, is that he has not gone mad from excitement. The tall and angular figure of the eldest Miss Chadd blocked the doorway as the door opened. Two other Miss Chadds seemed in the same way to be blocking the narrow passage in the little parlor. There was a general sense of their keeping something from view. They seemed like three black-clad ladies in some strange play of Metternich, veiling the catastrophe from the audience in the manner of a Greek chorus. "Sit down, won't you?" said one of them in a voice that was somewhat rigid with pain. "I think you had better be told first what has happened." Then, with her bleak face looking unmeaningly out of the window, she continued in an even and mechanical voice, "I had better state everything that occurred just as it occurred. This morning I was clearing away the breakfast things. My sisters were both somewhat unwell and had not come down. My brother had just gone out of the room, I believe, to fetch a book. He came back again, however, without it, and stood for some time staring at the empty grate. I said, "Were you looking for anything I could get?" He did not answer, but this constantly happens, as he is often very abstracted. I repeated my question, and still he did not answer. Sometimes he is so wrapped up in his studies that nothing but a touch on the shoulder would make him aware of one's presence. So I came around the table towards him. I really do not know how to describe the sensation which I then had. It seems simply silly, but at the moment it seemed something enormous, upsetting one's brain. The fact is, James was standing on one leg. Grant smiled slowly and rubbed his hands with a kind of care. "Standing on one leg," I repeated. "Yes," replied the dead voice of the woman without an inflection to suggest that she felt the fantasticality of her statement. "He was standing on the left leg and the right drawn up at a sharp angle, the toes pointing downwards. I asked him if his leg hurt him. His only answer was to shoot the leg straight at right angles to the other, as if pointing to the other with his toe to the wall. He was still looking quite gravely at the fireplace. "James, what is the matter?" I cried, for I was thoroughly frightened. James gave three kicks in the air with the right leg, flung up the other, gave three kicks in the air with it also, and spun around like a teetotum the other way. "Are you mad?" I cried. "Why don't you answer me?" He had come to a standstill facing me and was looking at me, as he always does, with his lifted eyebrows and great spectacled eyes. When I had spoken, he remained a second or two motionless, and then his only reply was to lift his left foot slowly from the floor and describe circles with it in the air. I rushed to the door and shouted for Christina. I will not dwell on the dreadful hours that followed. All three of us talked to him, implored him to speak to us with appeals that might have brought back the dead, but he had done nothing but hop and dance and kick with a solemn, silent face. It looks as if his legs belonged to someone else or were possessed by devils. He has never spoken to us from that time to this. "Where is he now?" I said, getting up in some agitation. "We ought not to leave him alone." "Dr. Coleman is with him," said Miss Chadd calmly. "They are in the garden. Dr. Coleman thought the air would do him good, and he could scarcely go into the street." Basil and I walked rapidly to the window which looked out on the garden. It was a small and somewhat smug suburban garden, the flower beds a little too neat and like the pattern of a colored carpet. But on this shining and opulent summer day, even they had the exuberance of something natural. I had almost said tropical. In the middle of a bright and verdant but painfully circular lawn stood two figures. One of them was a small, sharp-looking man with black whiskers and a very polished hat, I presume Dr. Coleman, who was talking very quietly and clearly, yet with a nervous twitch, as it were, in his face. The other was our old friend, listening with his old forbearing expression and owlish eyes, the strong sunlight gleaming on his glasses as the lamplight had gleamed the night before, when the boisterous Basil had rallied him on his studious decorum. But for one thing, the figure of this morning might have been the identical figure of last night. That one thing was that while the face listened reposefully, the legs were industriously dancing like the legs of a marionette.